Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Merkel Media.
Start looking at people like they don't matter. I'm waking up to the fact, more than a little bit shallow. I'm lost in this hole, but I don't wanna. I'm lost in this hole, 'cause I'm just trying to
good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First, I want to say thanks to everybody who's been giving 5-star reviews across the board on all the platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other of your favorite podcast streaming apps. I just want to say thank you so much. You have helped the show grow so much in just a little over half of a year, and it's been an amazing ride so far, and I look for an even longer journey with all of you. If you're a follower of the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go give a 5-star review on whatever platform you're on right now. And if you're new here, wait till you listen to the show, and if you liked it, then go give a 5-star review. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. And for the people that have been asking, how can I donate to the show to help the show grow financially? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can go to YouTube. You can become a member there. There's several different tiers. Also, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, and you can give a one-time donation, or you can set up a new monthly donation if you'd like to donate monthly. I appreciate everything you guys are doing for the show. Now let's get into it. What's good, guys? I'm glad to be back with you for another week of Free the Rabbits. And I got a fun episode today that I found some interesting correlations between one of the biggest occult leaders of all time, Jack Parsons, and the Demon Corps. And we're going to talk about what the Demon Corps is today. If you don't already know, I know there's been some podcasters out there do some episodes about the Demon Corps. One of the things that they don't bring in is the correlation between atomic energy and the occult. And there is a crazy connection between that. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today, too. And like I like to do on this show a lot is to break things down to the nth degree to start with, because sometimes I jump headlong into things, or at least in the past I did. I'll start talking about certain characters throughout history and just assume people know who they are. And not everybody does. And I think that's important to be able to talk to at least somewhat some of these people's backgrounds, where they came from. We'll talk a little bit about Aleister Crowley today, too, because he is tied in directly to Jack Parsons, and some of Crowley's work is going to tie in directly to Jack Parsons and this idea of atomic energy. And I've already done some really deep dives on Crowley already. So if you need to go back to those as a refresher course to understand Crowley's early background, you can do that. I won't be doing that today. However, I will summarize a little bit of Jack Parsons' life, because I haven't really talked about Parsons on the show outside of an episode I did with Isaac Weishaupt where we talked about Parsons briefly. I haven't really talked about his past. And listen, this isn't just a Parsons episode. So just know that I will do future episodes about Jack Parsons, because it's such a dense topic, just like Crowley, just like any of these other great occultists throughout history, that to really delve into these guys, I don't think you're ever going to finish the work. So it's more of a conglomeration of a lot of different episodes where we'll get to who these people are and what they did. And just to throw this out there, when I said great occultist, I don't mean great in the sense of they were doing great things or they were good people. What I mean is in their field, they were considered great. So I just want to put that out there. I know there will probably be some people here, great occultists, and say, ha ha, I caught him. He's admitting the truth. So I just want to make sure people understood that. But first, I'm going to start with the idea of nuclear technology. We'll get into a little bit of what nuclear technology is, and we'll also talk about the two atomic bombs that were dropped during World War II, because that's important, because that's going to tie us into Jack Parsons. It'll also tie us into some of his work after World War II, which will directly tie into Crowley, and we will also end with what the Demon Corps was and how that Jack Parsons is tied into the Demon Corps. Now, I want to say this about Jack Parsons. From all indication, historically, we don't know of him being tied directly to this Demon Corps, but his work would suggest that the people who were working on this Demon Corps had to have known who he was. They were all working under the same umbrella of the Manhattan Project. So a lot of these people had to know each other and what they were actually creating, because I think that's important too. We don't actually know what atomic technology is. We know what they tell us atomic technology is, but we don't actually know all the components, or if they are giving us all the components the way that it is, we don't know the actual usage of atomic technology. So I think we have to look into what they're actually using it for, or what they have used it for. And we'll also talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki as well, because that's an important part of this. Also, before I get started, we will not be talking about today that nuclear bombs are fake. I've talked about this in the past. I don't know if I'll ever do another episode about nuclear bombs being fake or not. I am in the camp that they are not fake, that there is a real process of creating these nuclear weapons, but I can also say that they've left a lot out. Now, if you want to argue that footage from the Trinity test, some of those are manufactured, I'm not going to butt heads with you too hard there, because I've seen the footage and I understand what people are saying about it. So that part of it, yeah, that could be manufactured. That doesn't mean that there weren't tests at the Trinity testing site.
at all. It's very similar to footage of the moon landing. I understand why people would say that there are components of it that look fake. I understand that completely. But that doesn't mean that we didn't go to the moon. It just means that what they manufacture for us to see was to cover up what they really did or what was really seen on the moon. So we have to take that into account as well. The deeper layers of if something is presented as real and it's not real, what's the real goal? It's not always surface level what everyone thinks. Oh, the Earth's flat. That is totally the answer. Okay, maybe that's your answer to it. But let's just say, for instance, that the Earth's not flat and it's actually round and they showed us this fake footage. Well, why did they show it to us? It wasn't to hide the shape of the Earth. It was to hide whatever they were doing on the moon. So I do think that we have to look at everything as a whole. So a nuclear weapon is an explosive device that derives its destructive force from nuclear reactions, either fission or atomic bomb, or combination of fission and fusion reactions, thermonuclear bomb, producing a nuclear explosion. Both bomb types release large quantities of energy from relatively small amounts of matter. And that's always been a big part of the debate. What is the energy that's being released? Now, we know what they're telling us the energy is, but at the end of the day, what is the actual energy? And I think in the future, well, I know in the future, I will do an old Earth episode about ancient nuclear technology. And I think we may get a different viewpoint on what that energy is and where it derives from if we're looking at it from an ancient source. So I do think that when we're looking at the components of nuclear weapons, we know what they're telling us that it's comprised of. And it could for sure be comprised of these things, but it could also be some other things that are implemented in with it that we don't necessarily know. Also, even if it is comprised of exactly what they're telling us, what are they actually using it for? What was the Trinity testing site actually for? And I know that there are tons of different conspiracy theories about what was actually going on there. And we'll talk about a few of those today because I do think Jack Parsons is tied directly into that. And also this idea of the Demon Corps, which I will explain later on in the episode what the Demon Corps actually is. And if the conspiracies that surrounded it and the deaths of some of the people who were working on it, if there was more to it than just mishaps in a lab. So nuclear weapons have only twice been used in warfare, both times by the United States against Japan at the end of World War II. On August 6, 1945, the United States Army Air Forces detonated a uranium gun-type fission bomb nicknamed Little Boy over the Japanese city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, on August 9th, the USAAF detonated a plutonium implosion-type fission bomb nicknamed Fat Man over the Japanese city of Nagasaki. This resulted in the deaths of approximately 200,000 people between both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And since those two explosions, nuclear weapons have actually been detonated over 2,000 times for testing and demonstration. And there are countries that have nuclear weapons that we know of and detonated them: United States, Soviet Union, United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. People believe that Israel have them too, but there is no evidence of Israel having them outside of the fact that they use deliberate ambiguity in acknowledging that they have them. So they probably got them. Germany, Italy, Turkey, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Belarus are nuclear weapons sharing states. So they have nuclear weapons that they all have access to that they can use. Say if one country is about to be attacked by another country with nuclear weapons, then they'll have access to the shared weapons that they all have access to. South Africa is the only country to have independently developed and then renounced and dismantled its nuclear weapons. So they went back on the idea of nuclear weapons, so they don't have them anymore. And I talked about the estimation of 200,000 deaths between Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it said that around 140,000 of Hiroshima's population of 350,000 were killed in the bombing, and estimated around 74,000 people died in Nagasaki. There were actually leaflets dropped on August 6, 1945 in the morning. And the U.S., according to reports, they, and I saw this on a CIA website as well, that they dropped these leaflets telling the people to leave Hiroshima because there was danger coming. And that's where some of the conspiracies come from, that all these deaths didn't actually happen, that the city was cleared out before the bomb was dropped. So there are a small contingent of people out there who believe that the nuclear weapons didn't actually exist, that what they showed us on camera was fake, and that all of these countries are in cahoots together to siphon money off of each other and off the people that live under them by perpetuating fear across the globe to all of us and believing that nuclear weapons exist when they actually don't. I'm not in that camp. Now, I do think they perpetuate fear for sure, but I do think the nuclear weapons actually exist in some format, probably a lot of different formats because there's a lot of different kinds. And they use the idea of these to keep people in fear. And what's also interesting on this Central Intelligence Agency study in intelligence website also claims that leaflets were dropped on 33 cities. So Hiroshima was part of these 33 cities that they dropped the leaflets on. And the first thing that popped up in my conspiratorial mind was 33. And I know all the numerology and gematria nerds probably go crazy every time they hear that stuff. But I do believe in numerology and gematria. I'm just not a big proponent on every single little thing is a number. I mean, we could create something out of anything. I could pull any number and put it in some sort of gematria decoder, and it's going to mean something. And then I can say it means this because I can loosely tie it with something over here. But also, on the flip side, does it mean that people in positions of power who are part of certain secret societies and organizations who study the occult aren't using numbers for their own gain either? And I do think this is a very odd one that they dropped it on 33 cities. Also, photos of the Tokyo bombing, because they did air raids in Tokyo. Now, this was before they decided to drop a third nuclear bomb on Japan. And of course, they ended up not doing it. And this is what the Demon Core was this third bomb that they were planning on dropping on Japan. But there were plenty of air raids and fire bombings that were going on in Tokyo. And interestingly enough, 100,000 people died, and they took 33 photos of the Tokyo bombing, which was also super weird. And there were people that remember what happened. It was like balls of fire, which consumed the city. I think people forget about this because they think about the two nuclear bombs that blew up Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but they don't understand that there was a lot of fire bombings that were also going on in Japan, specifically Tokyo, where they killed a lot of people. So it wasn't that there weren't deaths in other parts. And as a matter of fact, there were more deaths in Tokyo with the fire bombings than there were in Nagasaki with one nuclear bomb. So I do think that people don't understand the full scope of what was going on during that war and how many deaths were actually caused on all fronts between all nations that were involved. Now, we do know about the Trinity test, which was the first test of a nuclear bomb to occur in the U.S. But many years after the Trinity test, the U.S. continued to spend a ludicrous amount of time and money detonating nuclear bombs all over the southwestern United States and in various parts of the Pacific Ocean. And as of now, a lot of that footage that was squirreled away, hidden away, the government pulled them out of the vaults and started showing us, like Bikini Atoll and many other places, especially when we're talking about the ocean or small islands right outside of the U.S. So there has been many nuclear testing sites where we have been mimicking what happened at the Trinity test sites, which also begs the question, if they were trying to do something nefarious during the Trinity testing, then you could also say that possibly these other tests were trying to do similar things, and we'll get into what those things could possibly be. But to get there, we need to talk about Jack Whiteside Parsons. And he was born October 2nd, 1914. And died June 17th, 1952, of his own volition. And we'll talk about how that happened. There's some weird stuff around his death as well. He was an American rocket engineer, chemist, and Thelemite, occultist. So Thelema is the religion that Aleister Crowley started. And again, I've talked about Crowley a lot, and I'll continue to talk about him more because I've got more episodes planned. But he was the one that started Thelema when he was dictated the Book of the Law by Iwas in Cairo. And Parsons ended up being one of his sons, very similar to Charles Stansfield Jones before him. And C.S. Jones was Crowley's quote unquote supernatural son that he figured out during the Amelanche workings in New York. But Jack Parsons ended up being another one of his sons. As a matter of fact, Crowley loved him from afar. They sent many letters back and forth. And Jack Parsons ended up running the OTO out in California for a bit. We'll talk about that in a little bit, too. Parsons was one of the principal founders of both the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, and Aerojet. He invented the first rocket engine to use castable composite rocket propellant and pioneered the advancement of both liquid fuel and solid fuel rockets. So this guy was a genius, but not in school. So that's the big caveat. And that's always the debate, right? Is school important for people who have a certain level of genius in a certain field? I don't think that it is. Also, I don't think that education in and of itself is a bad thing either. So I just think that we have to have a healthy dose of skepticism when it comes to what we're being fed or what we're being taught, a critical mind. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things that we can take from education that can help us advance in life or help us see certain things that we need to see to advance what we're trying to create. But in this case, with Jack Parsons, it didn't work. So when Jack Parsons was born, in October 2nd of 1914, his parents, Ruth Virginia Whiteside and Marvel H. Parsons, moved to California from Massachusetts the previous year and purchased a house on Scarf Street in downtown Los Angeles. But the marriage didn't last much longer, and Jack's dad dipped out on Ruth when she found out that he was sexually involved with a prostitute. She filed for divorce. Marvel left his dad and later joined the U.S. Armed Forces, reaching the rank of major, and married a woman with whom he had a son, Charles, who was a half-brother, and Jack only saw him once. So Ruth's parents, Walter and Carrie Whiteside, moved to California to be with Jack and their daughter, and they had a lot of money, and they moved to an upscale house on Orange Grove Boulevard in Pasadena, known as Millionaire's Mile, so they could all live together. Jack really didn't have a lot of friends in school. He didn't get along with a lot of people. As a matter of fact, a lot of the middle class or poorer children made fun of him for having a lot of money. He didn't really connect with others. That's when he got really into mythology and tales of King Arthur, and he loved reading Arabian Nights. He got really involved with the pulps or pulp magazines, like Amazing Stories. And this is where a lot of that science fiction was feeding a lot of these guys who wanted to create rockets. And this is where Jack Parsons got the idea to start creating rockets, was reading the pulps, which I find pulps really cool. I'd love to get a collection of pulps one day, some of the originals. I know it's tough to get a hold of some of the actual original ones, but they're really cool, and they do offer an insight into how a lot of these scientists were creating technology by reading these pulps and these science fiction books. And a lot of these guys were actually occultists as well, so they looked at it as a way to not only feed this scientific need that they have, but also understand the deeper mysteries of the universe. And this is when Parsons himself started getting into the occult at a young age. As a matter of fact, super similar to the father of the computer, Charles Babbage, at a young age, Parsons tried to invoke the devil into his bedroom using a ritual. And as a matter of fact, he got so worried that the invocation was successful, he was frightened into ceasing these activities, as far as we know. But that was him at a young age, and we do know that he got heavily, heavily bought in to occulted practices later on in life, which we will talk about. Now, he wasn't very popular. We talked about it in school. He created a really close bond with Edwards Forman, and he was a boy from a poor working class family, and he became Jack Parsons' protector. He protected him from the other bullies at school, and he kind of gave Parsons credibility to be able to move out of the school without having too much friction with some of the other classmates because they respected who Edwards Forman was. And Edwards Forman, by the way, was an American engineer and inventor known for his pioneering work in early rocketry in the United States. Forman, along with his collaborators in Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology, GALSIT, demonstrated the first practical jet-assisted takeoff, JATO, of an aircraft in the United States. And this was in conjunction with Jack Parsons. So as Jack Parsons moved into what he would become in his professional life, so did Edwards Forman, because they were friends. And at a young age, they were making rockets. They were making a homemade gunpowder-based rocket experiments in the nearby Arroyo Seco Canyon, as well as in Parsons' family backyard. They were blowing up the garden in the back. So both of them were using all kinds of different methods. They were getting available fireworks, cherry bombs, and they were trying to figure out how to increase the rocket fuel stability. They were actually trying to create rockets. They would use aluminum foil, all these different things as a kid, and they got really good at it. Now, Parsons went through a bunch of different schools. He studied privately at university school. He became editor of the school newspaper there, and he won an award for literary excellence. And there were teachers at nearby Caltech who were trying to guide him into chemistry. Part of the issue was, at that point in time, his family didn't have a lot of money, and they were losing money. So they ended up moving to a smaller house. He was actually having to work at a place called Hercules Powder Company, which he was also stealing chemicals from Hercules Powder Company and using them to help build rockets with Edwards Forman. So he was still working on his rocketry. And he, again, he was in and out of these schools. He enrolled at Pasadena Junior College, was there for a short time, and left because of his financial situation. And then he permanently started working for Hercules Powder Company, and that ended up not working out. So he decided he wanted to go to Stanford University and study chemistry, but he didn't have the money. Tuition was too high, and he returned to Pasadena. Now, when he's in Pasadena, January 1939, John and Francis Baxter, a brother and sister who befriended Jack and his current wife, Helen, took Jack to the Church of Thelema on Winona Boulevard, Hollywood, where he witnessed the performance of the Gnostic Mass. And I've talked about the Gnostic Mass before. Crowley performed that a lot. And he actually tried to perform it in Detroit when he was there trying to set up the first chapter of the OTO in the United States, which ended up falling through. And that's partially the reason why Crowley left the States at the time. And again, I've surmised that Crowley was in and out of the States as a secret agent most of his life. I know that we know of the 1914 to 1919 run that he had, and that's documented, but we don't know much before or after about him being in and out of the States. And I have theorized that he was in and out of the States many times. But He did perform the Gnostic Mass. Parsons was all about it. As a matter of fact, he started snatching up every bit of literature he could read from Aleister Crowley, and he got super deep into Thelema. And he came to believe in the reality of the Thelemic magic as a force that could be explained through quantum physics. So this goes to that idea that there are occultists in every facet of science and the government and also entertainment. But we know about that typically because we can see the symbolism in the signs. But when we're talking about in the scientific field, we don't hear about it as much because a lot of these names we don't really hear about. As a matter of fact, Jack Parsons was not on anybody's radar until much later after he died was when we started finding out about how involved Jack Parsons was with nuclear technology, with rocketry. And to be honest with you, he and his best friend Forman, they weren't looking to create rockets for destruction or nuclear technology for destruction. They did because that's how they got their funding from the government. But really, they were more interested in getting into space. They were more interested in seeing what was outside of the Earth itself and getting deep into the galaxy. That was their real goal. You got to understand, they were reading the pulps. They were reading science fiction. They were more about getting outside of the Earth itself. Now, in 1941, Jack and his wife Helen were initiated into the Agape Lodge. And the Agape Lodge was an American chapter of Ordo Templi Orientis, which is the OTO, founded in California in 1935 by Wilford Talbot Smith. And she was also the sister of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard's wife, Sarah Northrop Hollister. And she later married Wilfred Talbot Smith as well. So there's a lot of shenanigans going on in the OTO. And as a matter of fact, they promoted a open sexual lifestyle, no matter if you're married or not. And this is the life that Aleister Crowley promoted as a part of Do What Thou Wilt is the whole of the law. And this is the life that Jack Parsons tried to mimic. And he had a very interesting relationship with Crowley as well, where Crowley really, from all intents and purposes, liked Jack Parsons, but he also thought he was an idiot at times. And we'll talk about that today as well. And as Jack and Helen were initiated into this Agape Lodge, which was started by Wilfred Talbot Smith, it actually saw a lot of growth in 1939. While Parsons was at the Agape Lodge, he adopted the Thelemic motto of Thelema obtentium pro edero amoris nuptii, a Latin mistranslation of the establishment of Thelema through the rituals of love. The initials of this motto spelled out Tupan, T-O-P-A-N, also serving as the declaration Tupan. Commenting on Parsons' error of translation, Crowley actually makes fun of it and says, the motto which you mention is couched in a language beyond my powers of understanding. So Crowley was known to be super sarcastic in his letters when he was making fun of people, and he would do it to their face too. Crowley just didn't really care. And I think that's why, again, I've always said that people who gravitate to an anarchist mind or gravitate to the ideals of Thelema really gravitate to Crowley. And you can see a lot of musicians have over the years. You can see people in power have, because he was what a lot of people want to be. I don't care what anybody thinks. I do what I want. And I think that's why people gravitate to him so much, without knowing all along he was never really truly an anarchist. He was very, very dedicated to Great Britain, and he worked for them. And Parsons actually adopted the Thelemic title Frater Tupan, and that was an ode to the Thelemic motto, which he mistranslated. So it's kind of funny that he still took it and made it his own. So around that same time, there was an American aeronautical engineer and painter, and his name was Frank Joseph Molina. Now, Molina approached the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Army Air Corps Research to request funding for research into what they referred to as jet propulsion. Now, they decided to use that term to avoid the negative stigma attached to rocketry. Now, the military is interested in jet propulsion as a means of getting aircraft quickly airborne where there was insufficient room for a full-length runway, and gave the Rocket Research Group $1,000. And they put together a proposal for a jet-assisted takeoff, which was JADO, which we talked about earlier. And this was in 1939. And Parsons led the U.S. government sanctioned group in that. Now, when they started doing the test, he reported the rockets reached exhaust velocities of close to 5,000 miles per hour. That actually gave Caltech and Gaussett Group, which he was working with, an additional $10,000 from the AIAA. And for that JADO project that they were working on, they brought in other people from Caltech. And I know I've talked about Shin Shuzen before as well, and he was a part of that group. And during this period of time, there was a political repression that was going on called McCarthyism. And it was the persecution of left-wing individuals in a campaign spreading fear of communist and Soviet influence on American institutions of Soviet espionage in the United States during the late 1940s through 1950s. So a lot of these guys were getting picked off as being a part of communist movements through Hollywood, through governments, through science. They're all getting shipped out. And Shin Shuzen was one of them. And he was a part of that JADO project, and Shin Shuzen actually ended up being a straight up communist, which is hilarious. I've gotten a hold of several documents of letters that he wrote, and all of them were like, comrades, greetings, comrades. So, you know, he was a straight up communist for sure. And during this time, Jack Parsons also was hemmed up a few times by the government for possibly being a part of the communist movement. Now, he was a big old school leftist for sure, but he wasn't a part of any communist movement as far as we know. And they ended up finding that out. However, it did ruin certain aspects of his career, especially when he was moving towards certain breakthroughs and eventually towards the back end of his life. And this is partially the reason that he died, because he was doing experiments by himself in his own personal laboratories because he didn't have access to any government funding anymore. And they basically destroyed his name. And I don't think so much for McCarthyism as much as the occult, because once they found out that he was involved with the OTO and Thelema, they weren't having it because they knew what was involved with all that. And they had to ask him questions. He got interrogated over all that. And back to 1942 and JADO and Jack Parsons, because the government knew that Jack Parsons had left-wing politics and some of the other guys that worked with Gaussett, they made it a point that they were going to make these bombs work to help eradicate the communists. They even said that. So they definitely did everything they could to mitigate the issues they were having with the government so that they continue with their testing. Because that's the thing. Parsons had his own agendas when it came to rocketry and creating nuclear technology. It wasn't exactly what the government wanted, but he was doing what the government wanted to get there. So in 1945, Parsons and Forman, his best friend from childhood, they were dissociated from JPL and Aerojet. Again, a lot of it had to do with what Parsons was involved with the occult. And they founded the Ad Astra Engineering Company, under which Parsons founded the chemical manufacturing Vulcan Powder Company. And even with Ad Astra, the FBI was investigating them under suspicion of espionage when there were certain security agents from the Manhattan Project that discovered that Parsons and Forman had basically stolen a chemical that was used in top secret project and was known as X metal, but then they were cleared of any wrongdoing. And I think some of that had to do with because they were so closely attached to the Manhattan Project and what he was doing there with nuclear technology, they pretty much just let him slide and said, okay, well, that's, you're good. And it's also around this time that Jack Parsons meets L. Ron Hubbard. And if you don't know, L. Ron Hubbard, born March 13th, 1911, and died January 24th, 1986, was an American author and the founder of Scientology. And he also wrote a lot of the pulp science fiction and fantasy novels early in his career. So a lot of those pulps we talked about, he wrote those and he created Scientology, which a lot of people think that Scientology is purely science fiction. Now, I'm not going to go as far as that with Scientology. I do believe that there are entities that dictate things to people and they create religions around them. Doesn't mean that there aren't things that are falsified within them, but the way Scientology was constructed is very similar to some of these other secret society-like religions, similar to Mormonism, that are built on the basis of the way some of these secret societies were put together. And L. Ron Hubbard's no different. But L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons got really tight to the point that L. Ron Hubbard actually moved into a place called the Parsonage, which the Parsonage was a mansion that Jack Parsons bought in Pasadena, California. And he pretty much made it a conglomeration of not only people that were followers of Thelema, but many other types, from scientists, artists, musicians. He wanted anybody who wasn't normal in his mind. He actually put out an ad in the papers for any exotic types to apply for rooms, which I thought was super interesting. And L. Ron Hubbard actually moves in with him in this parsonage. And even though Hubbard had no formal training in magic, that's with the CK, he had an extraordinary amount of experience and understanding in the field. So he had a lot of head knowledge, book knowledge of what magic was, but he didn't have any practical applications to it. But Parsons loved him. As a matter of fact, Jack writes in a letter to Crowley, he says, "About 3 months ago, I met Captain L. Ron Hubbard, a writer and explorer of whom I had known for some time. He's a gentleman. He has red hair, green eyes, is honest and intelligent, which is laughable considering L. Ron Hubbard scams him later on. But we'll get to that in a second. And he says, we've become great friends. He moved in with me about 2 months ago. And although Betty and I are still friendly, she has transferred her sexual affections to him." So Betty, or Sarah Northrop Hollister, who I talked about earlier, was connected to Parsons in a sexual way. And Parsons was so infatuated with her. But as soon as L. Ron Hubbard comes into the scene, Betty dips on Parsons and starts messing around with L. Ron Hubbard, which Parsons is okay with to a point. He really wasn't okay, but he had to be okay because of the tenets of Thelema. And he's telling Crowley this in a letter. And he says, "She has transferred her sexual affections to him, L. Ron Hubbard. Although Ron has no formal training in magic, he has an extraordinary amount of experience and understanding in the field. From some of his experiences, I deduce he's in direct touch with his guardian angel." So this is a huge theme in Thelema, is getting in contact with your personal guardian angel, which Crowley had with Iwas. And Jack tells Crowley that L. Ron Hubbard describes his angel as a beautiful winged woman with red hair, whom he calls the Empress, who has guided him through his life and saved him many times. Recently, he says, because of some danger, she is called the Archangel Michael de Gardas, which I always find fascinating. They bring in some of the angelic beings from the actual Bible to be connected to them. They'll talk about Gabriel. They'll talk about Raphael. They'll talk about all of these different ones that are talked about in the Bible or apocryphal text and say that they're working with them, which is tough for me because they're so against Christianity, but yet the angelic beings from the Christian literature are working with them. And he talks about how he and L. Ron Hubbard and several of the other ones at the Parsonage are trying to bring about the Aeon of Horus, which that was Crowley's purpose. At least he said up front that was his purpose when he started Thelema, and that was to eventually bring the Antichrist into the equation as well. Now, during this period of time from 1942 to 1946, Jack Parsons was a key figure in the Manhattan Project, and we will jump back into the occult part of this equation in a little bit, but we got to jump into what he was doing with the Manhattan Project because that goes into the Trinity tests, and then we'll be able to talk more to what he was doing possibly with these nuclear weapons. Now, the Manhattan Project was a research and development program undertaken during World War II to produce the first nuclear weapons. It was led by the United States in collaboration with the United Kingdom and Canada. And from 1942 to 1946, the project was directed by Major General Leslie Groves of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Nuclear physicist Robert Oppenheimer was the director of the Los Alamos Laboratory, which we will talk about a lot today when we're talking about the Demon Corps. And that's where they designed the bombs. The Army program was designated the Manhattan District, and its first headquarters were in Manhattan, but there were several other places that they ended up putting them. And one of them was the Hanford site in Washington State. And I actually was talking to a guy when I was up in Washington State shooting a film about Bigfoot about some of the things that spawned out from the nuclear testing, or at least some of the underground testing that was going on in the facilities, because there are all kinds of cryptids in the area. And some people think that these were spawned from either experiments that were going on in Hanford site, or possibly the opening of portals or something along those lines, tearing the veil, which we will talk about during the Trinity test sightings. Now, the work on the weapons design was performed at Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico. And this is where Little Boy and Fat Man, which we talked about, which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were actually created. So Jack Parsons' involvement in the Manhattan Project ended in 1944, sorta. And he was, when we talked about, he was dismissed from JPL and the Aerojet due to his involvement in the OTO. And in 1943, he was actually working at the Los Alamos Laboratory as chief ordnance officer. So he was directly involved in creating the nuclear technology that ended up being used not only at the Trinity test sightings, but also in Hiroshima and Nagasaki as well. And I said kind of because he wasn't stripped of his security clearances until 1948 from Aerojet after being investigated by the FBI for what we talked about earlier, McCarthyism, and attending Communist Party meetings before World War II. And during that period of time where he was dismissed from JPL and Aerojet, sort of, because he still had security clearances up until 1948, this is when he got involved with the Babylon, working with L. Ron Hubbard. And that's a completely different episode for another day on what they were doing out in the desert, trying to conjure all kinds of things. But Jack Parsons was directly connected to what was going on in the Trinity test. So there is a huge thought pattern that what the United States government was doing during the nuclear tests in New Mexico, which, by the way, was on the 33rd parallel, for anyone that wants to talk about ley lines and why they were in that particular area, but also ties into the jumbo container, which is a big mystery what the jumbo container actually contained. We know what they said it contained, and I'll tell you that here in a second, but we'll also talk about what it possibly contained. So the bomb designed to be used at the Trinity site actually involved two explosions. First, there would be a conventional explosion involving a TNT, and then a fraction of a second later, the nuclear explosion, if a chain reaction was manufactured. If the chain reaction was maintained, the scientists were sure the TNT would explode, but they were initially unsure of the plutonium. Again, I know there's people argue about plutonium being a part of the equation. I think that it is. I don't think they're lying about that, but you know, that's to the people who think that nuclear bombs don't exist. If the chain reaction failed to occur, the TNT would blow the very rare and dangerous plutonium all over the countryside. Because of this possibility, Jumbo was designed and built. Originally, it was 25 feet long, 10 feet in diameter, and weighed 214 tons. Scientists were planning to put the bomb in this huge steel jug because it could contain the TNT explosion if the chain reaction failed to materialize. This would prevent the plutonium from being lost. If the explosion occurred as planned, Jumbo would be vaporized. So if the explosion didn't happen, they could keep the plutonium. They wouldn't lose it. If it did happen, everything would be vaporized. They brought it to the Trinity site, and they ended up not using it. They decided not to, and they placed it on a steel tower about 800 yards from ground zero, which was also super weird. Why they didn't use it, why they brought it out there. And today, it still rests at the entrance to ground zero, so all can see. The ends are missing. because in 1946, the Army detonated 8 500-pound bombs inside it. And because it was standing on end, the bombs were stacked in the bottom and the asymmetry of the explosion blew the ends off. So if you go there now, you'll see the jumbo container. And obviously, I'll show you pictures here if you're on YouTube or Rumble, how big it is. Now, we're going to get to the occult part of this and what they were trying to do out in New Mexico. And I know a lot of people will probably gravitate to Twin Peaks. And I will not be touching much on Twin Peaks. As a matter of fact, I really feel like there's only one guy who does Twin Peaks justice. And if you want to go listen to countless hours on Twin Peaks and its connection to the occult today, go listen to Isaac Weishaupt, Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture Podcast. And he has done absolutely terrific work on Twin Peaks. And to the absolute smallest minutia iota of information that you could possibly glean from that. And he's done it all. So again, I'll speak about Twin Peaks briefly here because I think it's important to this concept of what they were trying to either create or bring out at the Trinity test sighting. But to get there, we need to talk about Jack Parsons' death, because this is going to tie into this idea of the moon child or the homunculus and what the jumbo container actually contained. Was there a creation that was inside of it that they were trying to conjure or actually did when they said that they blew the ends off? And now it's clear, well, what was actually in it? We don't know. No one knows. And it's a big mystery of what's inside the jumbo container. But I'm going to jump to Parsons' death. I know I'm jumping around a lot today to make this make sense. So there's a lot of mystery around Parsons dying as well. Some people wonder, was it a dramatic suicide? And he had been working on an order for the Burmite Powder Company, and the chemicals that he got for that project would have been perfect to explode himself. But most people think that if he's going to off himself, he would have use something a lot easier than going by that way. Some people think he was murdered by a crooked cop because he was an expert witness. As a matter of fact, on the recommendation of Caltech, which he worked closely with a lot of people there, in the murder trial of LAPD Captain Earl Kennett, who killed a fellow cop with a bomb attached to his car ignition. Kennett was convicted and imprisoned, and Parsons made a replica of the bomb, and it became one of the most famous photographs from the high-profile trial. So basically, what he was able to put together as a replica to show how it worked, that it put Captain Earl Kennett away, and his first wife, Parsons, Marjorie Cameron, actually suggested that it was Kennett that, when he got out, he took Parsons out. I don't know if that's the case. Maybe. I mean, it would be poetic justice if he was to get out and then kill Parsons the same way that Parsons had him convicted. Some people think he was murdered by Howard Hughes. There's a little bit of evidence that it's a possibility, but I don't think that Howard Hughes has anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, Howard Hughes wasn't even close by. Now, he could have paid somebody to do it. But I think the last idea of how that he died, I think, is the most fascinating one. And I think it ties right back into the jumbo container. I think it ties right into Crowley and what Crowley was trying to create with the moon child and what the homunculus actually is. So after Parsons' death, Marjorie Cameron, who is a widow now, stayed for a few months with her friend, actress and director Renata Drux, and countless hours of conversation, Drux reported that her belief was that the explosion was a result of Parsons trying to create a homunculus, a small magical being with special powers. And I will direct you, if you want to learn all about homunculus to the fullest extent, go talk to my friend Juan Ayala of the One-on-One podcast, and that is his specialty. So he can break down the homunculus far more than I can, but it is important to this story because the Moon Child, which is a book that Crowley wrote, we're going to talk about here in a second, was based on creating a homunculus, at least in the format that Crowley believed that you could create them in, that this is directly tied into Jack Parsons and also the Trinity test sighting as well, because while there are ideas that what they were doing out there was tearing the veil and bringing stuff in, i.e. Twin Peaks talks about that, but also they were trying to create a homunculus. And some people have theorized that this homunculus was inside of this jumbo container, and the energy that they were trying to manufacture there, or possibly did, was to bring life into whatever, for lack of a better word, meat sack that was inside of this jumbo container. And maybe whatever they brought through this rift was finding its way into this meat sack. Again, we're in total speculation and theorizing, but we can say that the idea of the homunculus and bringing entities into something that's either inanimate or doesn't have a soul, that you're bringing a soul into another life form, that this is talked about extensively throughout the occult. And as a matter of fact, Parsons was very much on board with this because Crowley was a big proponent of this. So we've got Renata Drux, who believed that Parsons was actually trying to create this magical little being, this homunculus, in his lab, and ended up exploding himself trying to do so. Well, this would make sense if they were already doing it in government operations and he was trying to do it more on a small scale and probably didn't have access to a lot of things he had before. So this is where we bring those ties together, that this is actually possible. Now, the idea of the moon child or this homunculus is actually talked about in chapter 8 of Moonchild, written by Aleister Crowley, of the homunculus, conclusion of the former argument concerning the nature of the soul. And I've talked briefly about Moonchild before. I want to say we talked about it on the Joseph Smith, Aleister Crowley connection episode I did with Heidi Love. And the idea that these characters in the book are actually representation of characters that Crowley knew. We know that for a fact. Simon Iff, who was Theodore Roos, and was head of the OTO at the time and mentor to Crowley, is a big part of this chapter. We got Lisa Jufria, who was Mary D'Este, and she was the mother of Preston Sturges, who helped Crowley write his magnum opus Magic Book 4. And then we've got Brother Cyril, who is Aleister Crowley himself. And they're all talking together. And Simon Iff is talking to specifically Lisa here because she's the one that's going to have to take on this burden of the homunculus being created inside her. And he's explaining a few things to her. He said, "So we'll go. I'm going to talk to you about the soul again. Remember our conception of it, the idea that seemed to do away with all the difficulties at a blow. We had the idea of a soul, a real physical substance, one of whose surfaces are rather boundary solids, was what we call body and mind. Body and mind are real too and truly belong to the soul, but are only minute aspects of it, just as any ellipse or hyperbola is an aspect of the section of a cone." Now, Simon Iff is still talking to Lisa and says, "How do solids know one another almost entirely by their surfaces, except in chemistry, which we have reason to believe to be a fourth dimensional science," which that's talked about plenty when it comes to different aspects of chemistry. "Witness the phenomena of 80 polarization of geometrical isomerism. Solids only make contact superficially. Then, shifting the analogy as we did before, how do fourth dimensional beings know one another? By their bounding solids. In other words, my soul speaks to yours through the medium of our minds and bodies." So he's talking about how souls will actually understand each other before the mind does, before the body does. He's explaining that the soul is its own entity, and he's getting to the point where he's letting her know that souls are out there, and souls are looking for an embryo to go inside, and they're actually fighting each other if there is an embryo which is of greater importance. Say they come from a more high-class family, have better genetics. He gets into all this with her here, and he talks about how that there is a way to manipulate this. And he says, "Look at the finished product, the soul incarnate, as we may call it. There are three forces that work upon it, the soul itself, the heredity, and the environment." So he's talking about these three pieces. A clever soul will therefore be careful to choose the embryo, which seems most likely to be fairly free in the two latter respects. It will look for a healthy stock for parents who will and can give the child every chance in life. You must remember that every soul is, from our point of view, a genius, for its world is so incalculably greater than ours that one spark of its knowledge is enough to kindle a new epoch in mankind. So he's suggesting that every soul is on the same tier of intelligence and genius. It's just depending on what meat sack that they get inside of that then changes how intelligent or smart or how successful that person's going to be, because there are a lot of factors. He's breaking down those factors of how, but he's also getting to the point of showing how that they can manipulate this process. And he says, so we may perhaps conceive of some competition between souls for possession of different minds and bodies, or let us say to combine the ideas, different embryos. Hope you notice how this theory moves the objection to reincarnation, that one's mind does not remember the last time. So he's also talking about reincarnation, and this ties also into the Gnostic views. And we talked about the Halls of Amenti on the last episode and how that plays into this idea of getting to the finish line and you're not worthy, so you get reincarnated back. So your soul's thrown back into the host of souls, and then they're looking for another meat sack to get inside of, and hopefully that they'll get into a better meat sack this time so that they can transgress themselves, shed more of the ego, and then be able to get past the Halls of Amenti and move into the Pleroma. Now, he says, this brings us to the consideration of certain experiments made by our predecessors. They had quite another theory of souls, at least. Their language is very different to ours, but they wanted very much to produce a man who should not be bound up in his heredity and should have the environment which they desired for him. They started in paraphysical ways. That is, they repudiated natural generation altogether. They made figures of brass and tried to introduce souls to indwell them. In some accounts, we read that they succeeded. Friar Bacon was credited with one such homunculus, so was Albertus Magnus, and he says also, I think, Paracelsus, which Paracelsus for sure was one of the first people to ever talk about creating a homunculus. Now, he gets to the part of telling Lisa exactly how they're going to do this. Man, they said, is merely a fertilized ovum properly incubated. So he's talking about incubation, even brings the idea of the chicken egg as being incubated. And he says, heredity is there even at first, of course, but in a feeble degree. Anyhow, they could arrange any desired environment from the beginning. He's talking about being able to manipulate the soul into where they want it to go, and it would be an embryo of their own creation. He says, furthermore, this is the crucial point, that they thought by performing this experiment in a specially prepared place, and I'm going to talk about what kind of place that Crowley was talking about, a place protected magically against all incompatible forces, and by invoking into that place someone force which they desired, some tremendously powerful being, angel, or archangel, and they had conjurations which they thought capable of doing this, they would be able to cause the incarnation of beings of infinite knowledge and power, who would be able to bring the whole world into light and truth. So he's trying to create this moon child, and he's bringing Lisa on board with this. She says she's okay with this in chapter 8, and that leads into the rest of the story. And feel free to go download it for free online. There is plenty of PDFs out there of moon child. But that was one book that Jack Parsons absolutely loved. And I know some people are very divided on what they think about the book. I have read a lot of Crowley over the years, and I find the book fascinating because I understand the deeper layers of it. Some people find it very mundane, and, you know, some people don't even like the way Crowley wrote, and they think he was kind of a mediocre writer. And I guess in some aspects, if you're looking at it from a gripping standpoint, a lot of times he didn't have that. But to me, it's gripping because I understand the deeper layers of it. Now, that book, Moonchild, is, in my opinion, based more on Liber 367, which is De Homunculo of the Homunculus, which Crowley wrote, as a matter of fact. And he talks about how to do this. He says, a homunculus is a living being in form, resembling man and possessing those qualities of man which distinguish him from beast, namely intellect and power of speech, but neither begotten and born after the manner of human generation nor inhabited by a human soul. And I've talked about this Liber 367 before on this show. And I want to say I talked about it on Jesus the Homunculus with Juan Ayala when we did that episode. But he basically talks about how they take the fertilized ova of a woman to reproduce without the uterus. So they take it out of the uterus. And with the connection of these angel kind, and he actually names them, Graphiel, Nakiel, Raphael, Haniel, Aniel, he said, with them, they're able to find a spirit that is suitable for the fetus. So when they implement the sperm into the egg and they are creating the fetus at 3 months, according to Crowley, is when they are to implement this soul or spirit into the fetus to create this homunculus. So basically they are doing what I think they're doing with like IVF and some of these other things where they're putting all these things in a petri dish and then they're implementing something else in with it. Now, this is Crowley's words on it. And you can also go download Libra 367. There's more to it, but that's the basic gist of it. And this is the non-fictionalized version of Crowley creating a moon child. So he does have an actual magical document on how to do it. And all of these Jack Parsons would have been reading. So to say it's a stretch that he was trying to create something like that and exploded himself, I don't think it's a stretch at all. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that in conjunction with the government out in New Mexico, that these tests had way more going on to them than just they were testing these nuclear bombs to then send over to Hiroshima or Nagasaki. As a matter of fact, for the people out there who are against nuclear bombs even existing, I think you guys would be more on board with this than anything because of the fact that they weren't doing the particular testing they said they were doing. And maybe that's why they made these videos of the test that possibly weren't true, because the tests themselves were not at all what they said they were. Before we jump off the homunculus part of this completely and jump into the Demon Core, interesting, Mark Frost, who was one of the co-creators of Twin Peaks with David Lynch, he did an AMA, Ask Me Anything, on Reddit several years ago, and someone asked him on his actual AMA Reddit page what he thought happened to Parsons when he died. And Mark Frost said that he thought that he was trying to create a homunculus. So he actually came out and said that. So this is one of the creators of Twin Peaks that said that he believed also that Jack Parsons was trying to create a homunculus at his death, and that's why he exploded. So we're going to move into this Demon Core. The Demon Core was a sphere of plutonium that was involved in two fatal radiation accidents when scientists tested it as a fissile core of an early atomic bomb. It was manufactured in 1945 by the Manhattan Project. So this was in Los Alamos, so we talked about that already. And the U.S. nuclear weapon development effort during World War II. It was a subcritical mass that weighed 6.2 kilograms and was 8.9 centimeters in diameter. The core was prepared for shipment to the Pacific Theater as part of a third nuclear weapon to be dropped on Japan. But when Japan surrendered, the core was retained for testing and potential later use in the case of another conflict, which I find fascinating that they kept it. And nobody knows what exactly is going on. They said they kept repurposing the plutonium that was in it. We don't really know. We don't even know what its real purpose is because it never left. Now, the time frame is really odd in these 1940s, right? There's a lot going on, a lot of occult activity going on, a lot of UFO activity going on, a lot of war going on, a lot of nuclear technology is being implemented. We know in 1945, the Trinity test happened. The Demon Core was created. The first incident, which we're going to talk about, of the Demon Core happened. August 6th, Hiroshima got blown up. August 9th, Nagasaki got blown up. That's just 1945. 1946, Babylon Working happened, which I briefly talked about, which again, I'm not getting into all that today with what Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard were doing out there. And then the second incident of the Demon Core happened in 1946. 1947, Roswell happens with the supposed UFO crash and bodies of gray aliens. Aleister Crowley dies in 1947. And I think there's a huge connection between him and Roswell. And maybe I'll talk about that on a later episode. And the mysterious Majestic 12 or M12 that was created with President Harry S. Truman, or supposedly created with Harry S. Truman in a response to Roswell, also happened in 1947, or supposedly happened in 1947. So a lot's going on just in those 3 years. But there's a lot going on in the 1940s in general. And I think a lot of things that happened in the 1940s really shifted where the world started to go when it came to the mixing of science fiction and science itself, which I think a lot of science fiction is probably truth. And it's just presented as fiction, very much like Aleister Crowley wrote Moonchild, which was a completely fictional piece of work, but had a lot of Crowley's own ideas of magic and the occult. And to the two accidents that happened, which were very mysterious, with the Demon Corps, they both occurred at the Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico. The first one on August 21st, 1945, and the second one on May 21st, 1946. And you have to ask, too, because Los Alamos became known as a secret city. Residents had to enter through a gate, show identification. Town wasn't even on the map. We know that Jack Parsons worked at Los Alamos. So what kind of influence did he have on the Demon Corps itself? Or at least what research that he had done, how was that connected to the Demon Corps? I did a lot of digging to find any bit of or shred of evidence that would tie him directly to the Demon Corps. I couldn't find it. But I want to say that if we're going to suggest that the government was doing some nefarious things out of New Mexico with the Trinity test, and this Demon Corps was set up to be the third nuclear bomb they were going to drop in Japan before Japan surrendered, we got to ask the question, you know, what were these nuclear bombs actually doing? You know, were they there to blow people up like we're told? Or were they set to rip the fabric of time and space? And maybe we have to suggest both in this particular instance, and especially with something like the Demon Corps, which, by the way, it was originally called Rufus. After the two accidents, it became known as the Demon Corps. But that doesn't mean that they didn't start calling it the Demon Corps because of other purposes that it might have been created for. And now the first incident happened on August 21st, 1945, and the plutonium core produced a burst of neutron radiation that resulted in physicist Harry Daghlian's death. Daghlian made a mistake while performing neutron reflector experiments on the core. He's working alone. A security guard, Private Robert J. Hemmerly, was seated at a desk 10 to 12 feet away. The core was placed within a stack of neutron reflective tungsten carbide bricks, and the addition of each brick made the assembly closer to criticality. So what they're doing is they're testing, according to them, the criticality of what it would take for the chain reaction to go critical. And they want to get as close as possible as they can to understand what it's going to take for the weapon to go critical while attempting to stack another brick on top around the assembly. Daghlian accidentally dropped it onto the core and thereby caused the core to go well into supercriticality and self-sustaining critical chain reaction. He quickly moved the brick off the assembly, but he received a fatal dose of radiation. He died 25 days later from acute radiation poisoning. And Daghlian was an American physicist with the Manhattan Project, which was designed to produce the atomic bombs that were used during World War II. So he's a huge part of this. And you have to ask, what kind of connection might he had with Parsons, or at least Parsons' work in conjunction with this testing of the Demon Corps? And we're also going to talk about the second incident. And Daghlian was the assistant to the second guy, Louis Slotin, who was a part of the second accident that happened. Now, Louis Slotin was a Canadian physicist and chemist who took part in the Manhattan Project. And you understand the Manhattan Project was three different nations involved: US, Canada, UK. And they had people from all three countries involved with this. So Louis Slotin was Canadian, and in 1942, he was invited to participate in the Manhattan Project and subsequently perform experiments with uranium and plutonium cores to determine their critical mass values. And he was also at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. And he was there specifically during the time that Jack Parsons was there. And so was Harry Daghlian. So there's no way they didn't know who Jack Parsons was. So I would have to think that in some capacity, they were working together, if not directly, at least sharing information. So part of the testing, when Slotin was a part of it, it required the operator to place two half spheres of beryllium, that's a neutron reflector, around the core to be tested and manually lower the top reflector over the core using a thumb hole at the polar point. As the reflectors were manually moved closer and farther away from each other, neutron detectors indicated the core's neutron multiplication rate. The experimenter needed to maintain a slight separation between the reflector halves to allow enough neutrons to escape from the core in order to stay below criticality. So basically, the closer that the spheres came to each other, the closer that the bomb would reach criticality. And oddly, Slotin, during one of these tests, he would create a gap that was maintained by the blade of a flat-tip screwdriver in his hand. And the size of the gap between the reflectors was changed by twisting the screwdriver. So he had been doing this several times, but it was actually unapproved protocol, even by his own standards. But he had a lot of hubris, and he just believed that he could just keep doing this. So on the day of the accident, Slotin's screwdriver slipped outward a fraction of an inch while he's lowering the top reflector, allowing the reflector to fall into place around the core. Instantly, there was a flash of light. The core becomes supercritical, releasing an intense burst of neutron radiation. Slotin quickly twisted his wrist, flipping the top shell to the floor. And I'll show you a picture of his hand, which looks insane, that happened to him. He jetted off to the hospital, and he died 9 days later from acute radiation poisoning. So the part of it that's super weird is you got these guys who are working together, that understand the process, and that are not really following the rules of the process. So you got to ask, was this some sort of cover-up? Was there something else going on with this particular demon core that they were trying to use it for? What was the testing? You know, especially if we're going to go into the Trinity test site and say that they were trying to tear a veil, bring something in, create something like an homunculus. If we're even going to go down that occult route, which we know a lot of these guys were occultists, you know, what was actually going on with Slotin and Haglian? And what they were trying to actually do. We only know what they're telling us happened. And you got guys who are professionals who are both having issues, and they work together. So why is it that this particular device, which is supposed to be the third nuclear weapon that's dropped on Japan, ended up not being? And they're doing testing on this to the point that after the second incident, they took the plutonium and they moved it to a non-disclosed location, and they said they used it for other testing, which they said they used it at Bikini Atoll. We don't really know if that's the case. We don't even know what was going on at Bikini Atoll. Like, what were they trying to do during that stretch? I've done some research on all that there, and oddly enough, and some weird stuff happening on the Marshall Islands even prior to that. And when it comes to cryptids, when it comes to some weird things that were seen under the water, you know, what were they really doing out there in the Marshall Islands? We don't know. Maybe they did take the plutonium from the demon core. Maybe they took the demon core itself and brought it out there and tried to tear another veil. Maybe they did. We don't really know. And again, I'm into pure speculation and theorizing, but there's a lot of evidence that from a cult standpoint that they were trying to use nuclear testing, at least the testing part of it, for something. Now, what they were able to do, we don't really know. That's all speculation. Was Hiroshima and Nagasaki a part of that too? Hard to say. Was the demon core itself a part of that? Hard to say. Now, what I can say is, though, that Jack Parsons was more than likely working on all this stuff, or at least his studies on it were being used by some of the other guys. So if he was a part of trying to pull out an entity in New Mexico as a part of the Trinity test. And that was the precursor to what was going to happen in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then you've got this third bomb, which is conveniently called a Demon Core. And they say, oh, yeah, yeah, we called it that later. It was Rufus first. We called it that later after these incidences. Well, maybe it was already some sort of Demon Core. You know, I talked to somebody recently and I wasn't able to verify this. So don't take this as any kind of word. And I looked high and low. And I need to talk to this person who's also a researcher and podcaster about where they found this at. But they did say that some of the people in the lab after these two incidences, they were hearing voices and hearing things that were supernatural after this happened. So if, it's a big if, take that part of it with a grain of salt. But if that was part of it, then that also lends in the fact that maybe these explosions did bring something in. Or at least stirred something up. So I do find this connection between Jack Parsons' Moon Children and the Trinity test, along with the explosions in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Demon Core, to have some sort of connected tissue there because of the fact that Jack Parsons himself was known to say that he was trying to bring things in from the other world or another dimension. So if that's the case, and he was working closely with the government on some of this, which I actually think he was, I don't think that they were completely blinded to the OTO and him following the Lima. I think they knew all along. They wouldn't have been stupid to that. I just think they used that as an excuse to get him off of the Manhattan Project and some of these other projects because of what they were actually using them for. It's the easiest way to get the heat off of them. Well, let's get the guy who's giving us the way to bring these entities in or create some sort of humanoid weapon. Again, speculation. Let's get rid of that guy. Maybe his death wasn't him creating a homunculus. Maybe they did off him. But I do like the homunculus idea because it seems to be that people that are involved with the occult think that that's what he was doing, especially with how close he was to Crowley and how Crowley was super invested in creating Moon Children. Well, guys, I had a blast this week on another episode of Free the Rabbits. And I know this was a very all over the place type episode, but I'm hoping that I reeled it in like I do towards the back end and brought all the connective tissue together. But I hope you enjoyed it, and this won't be the last time I talk about Jack Parsons, and I will talk about some other aspects of him throughout because I think that he's got some very interesting parts of his life, especially when we dig into the more occulted aspects of it and move away from some of the science part of it. But I thought this was an interesting thread that I was able to bring together when it came to Jack Parsons, Moon Children, and the Demon Core. Again, guys, hope you had a great time. If you can, go give a 5-star review in whatever platform you can. If you're on YouTube or Rumble, make sure you comment, like, subscribe. If you're on any of the other platforms, go give a 5-star review. Go write a review. All that stuff helps the show get out deeper into the algorithm so other people can get access to the show that don't normally get to the show. And on the way out, we're going to play my song, Plato's Cave. And you know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole. I'm feeling what shocks us, does us in. We just love what's toxic and we binge. Think we're free when we're on the fringe. But we're lost, yeah, we're lost, yeah, we're lost. Dancing to the flicker, hear the laughter. We just think that it's normal in the past, yeah.
Jesus prayed in the garden while his friends slept. Aye. We're just broken pieces to the gold and no missteps. Aye. I'm here to break down all your idols ritualistic. Yeah. If you don't like it, I don't speak in euphemistic terms. Whoa. The world is run by Charles Montgomery Burns. They keeping it hooded like CERN. They've done it in thirds before the earth was occurred. And all the friction I'm getting is warranted when your chambers don't echo. The insurance needed for what I be saying don't come from progressive or gecko. And why are you popping Prosecco if you ain't putting in labor? I'm taking shots of espresso. Every second I favor more than the last. We never get a return on time lost with the divine laws. But people looking to rap it like tacos with lime sauce. Hey, I never cared too much what they saying. Matter of fact, what I'm saying, I ain't here to explain it. On the levels all they see, but they don't see my creator. Campaign of politicians for your souls, no debate. Stop for the next, I'm calling them Benedict Arnold, I got me a chopper. Most of our collars are blue, most of us can't even afford one. Lining up for new iPhones and Jordans. It ain't our blessings and we praying for misfortunes. On others, on our socials, feeling so important. I'm breaking you down, ain't here to make you feel comfortable. Just avowing the opposite sex while creating the monsters of hotness. These hells we create for ourselves, timelines are nothing but cells.
Shadows dance and they came from our mouth.